Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I am Anna Fishson, your host, and today it's my pleasure to be speaking with Stephen Ellman about his magisterial book, When Theories Touch, A Historical and Theoretical Integration of Psychoanalytic Thought, published by Carnac in 2010. Steve, welcome. It's great to have you on.
Well, it's nice to be here. Thank you, Anna.
It's our pleasure. So, okay, first I'm going to briefly introduce you. Stephen J. Ellman earned a PhD in clinical psychology in 1968 from New York University and graduated in 1982 from the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research, also known as IPTAR. His postdoctoral training was in the psychology and neurophysiology of sleep and dreams at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, after which he became a professor in the Graduate School of City University of New York, or CUNY. Throughout most of his career, he has been both a clinician and researcher. At CUNY, he was director of the PhD program in clinical psychology and is now, after 30 years as professor at CUNY, professor emeritus. He has published more than 70 papers on psychoanalysis, sleep, and dreams, and the neurophysiology of motivation. In addition, he has published and co-edited 4 psychoanalytic volumes and 2 volumes on sleep and dreams, the best known of which are Freud's Technique Papers, A Contemporary Perspective, published in 1991 with Jason Aronson, and The Mind and Sleep with John Antrobus, published in 1991 by Wiley. He's been president of IPTAR twice and is currently a training and supervising analyst at IPTAR. He's also a clinical professor in the New York University postdoctoral program in psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. Steve was the first president of the Confederation of Independent Psychoanalytic Societies, which is the national professional organization of the independent IPA societies of the U.S., and was previously on the executive council of the IPA. He is a member of the American Psychological Association and has held many editorial positions on various psychoanalytic journals. Wow, you've been busy. Okay, so question number one, I guess. I'd like to actually begin by asking, what inspired you to write the book, but maybe more specifically, whence the integrative impulse?
Well, that's a, in as you were talking, I was also, since I probably know my bio fairly well, I was looking and seeing, the preface to my book. I thought I'd get it out since I haven't looked at it for a long time. And that is, since I began teaching, I've always taught a variety of authors. Before I became politically aware, I remember telling Bob Holt, a professor of mine at NYU, that I was really, and Bob, of course, was a well-known Freudian critic and scholar, as with Bob Holt. Bob Holt, George Klein, and Merton Gill was there at the time, as well as Leo Goldberger and others. Bob Langs was in and out of the research center. And I said, I really like, some of Searles's work. And Bob said to me, well, he's he tends to be an interpersonalist. And I said, okay. Wasn't exactly sure, was that a good thing or a bad thing? I said, yeah, but I thought he described, some of my interest in schizophrenia, in a very vivid clinical way. And then Bob was very mild in his critique. But when I told Merton that, Merton was much stronger. Merton was still a Freudian at that point, and educated me that politically Searles was out. But I never quite went along with the political niceties of this. And when I began to teach a course in disorders of the self, it included Hartman, Jacobson, Searles, some aspects of Sullivan, because I was interested in some of Sullivan's writings, etc., as well as Guntrip, who I met. Guntrip was very nice to me because I liked some of his books and wrote to him, and he wrote back. And when he came to speak at White, he had lunch with me and spent an afternoon telling me about all the authors I should read, which then got me to read Klein, as well as Fairbairn, which Guntrip strongly recommended, but he most strongly recommended Winnicott. Mm-hmm. And so that began my course in object relations theory. And I began to feel more and more, particularly as I went, since my first analytic institute was New York Psychoanalytic, I began to feel more and more that what divided people was much more political than substantive in many ways. And when I started teaching the course on object relations theory, it was then the integrative impulse came into being, but also a strong liaison with Edith Jacobson, who I feel in her work is quite integrative, and people don't appreciate it. And if you read my book, you'll see that there isn't a chapter on Jacobson, because my chapter on Jacobson was so long that the publisher said, 700 pages is enough. We can't have another 80 pages on Jacobson.
Right.
He also cut down my chapter on Beyond. So.
Okay. So, well, yeah, it's interesting. I actually want to give the this connects to what I was going to be my next question, but I wanted to give the audience a better sense of the structure of the book and what is included. So it consists of I think 18, if I'm not mistaken, main body chapters, not including the
book. Yes.
Yeah, not including the epilogue, and right. The first four are in Freud, and they're a tour de force, I think. And then there's a chapter on Anna Freud and ego psychology, a few on Klein and the controversial discussions. There's one, a chapter on Fairbairn, a long chapter on Winnicott, followed by chapters on Sullivan, Mahler, Kohut, Kernberg, Bion, contemporary conflict theory, relational theory, and an integrative chapter. And I think the last chapter is called a tentative developmental model, which is another sort of another integrative effort. So, and each chapter has a commentary section where you do much of your interpretive and integrative labor.
Well, I like it as you describe it.
So given all that, I wanted to ask what. With a book like this, it's of course tempting to ask if there's any theorist you wish now that you'd included or left out. Because right away I noticed, especially given my interests, fans of this program will know this, I noticed that there's no Lacan, there's nobody French. They seem omitted. But also, there's no Ferenczi, there's no Erikson. I mean, there are a couple of examples of there's sort of a couple omissions, I would say, that are fairly glaring. So, I'm curious what drove the decision to put some people in, take some people out, et cetera.
Well, part of the decision was pragmatic.
Mm.
I had a criteria. If I hadn't read everything that the author had written and gone over it a couple of times, I didn't really feel I was inside the author's perspective, and I really wanted to feel like I was inside the author's perspective. And as I was writing various chapters, I noticed I started making Fairbairn-like interpretations of patients and, Cohutian interventions at other points. So that was one criteria. I wanted to... It's not true that I didn't include any aspect of Ferenczi. I mean, there are various mentions of Ferenczi.
That's true. Yeah.
There should have been more, around that. So, but the big omission to me is Lacan, and I just didn't feel I knew Lacan well enough. I knew other French. I mean, I know, you know, I've been through the Bergstedt-Breen book on French psychoanalysis, and I've spoken in France, you know, several times, and twice been in, you know, integrative North American France psychoanalytic weekends, or I guess they were longer than weekends. So I knew certainly Laplanche's work well, and I'm going back over that, and André Green's work well. I didn't really feel I knew Lacan's work well, and I felt that I was somewhat a victim of a transferential bias of the IPA. And I should have known. Also, I don't know, Richard Ellman is my cousin.
Hmm.
And in one of the last things he wrote to his daughter, Maud Ellman, who's now a professor at the University of Chicago, was, you shouldn't be so taken with Lacan. You should really, you know, go back and read Freud. So I thought that Dick was perhaps writing to me as well, but probably not. But, you know, I think Lacan is, and I wrote in the book, I think Lacan is the glaring weakness from my perspective. Mm. It, you know, Lacan should be there. If I ever was going to do a revised version of this book, I can't imagine it would be too
volume long. Two.
Volume two. That would tax the reader, it seems to me. But
you could compare Object Day and Transitional Phenomena. You can really link Winnicott. It would be, anyway, that's just my fantasy.
Yeah, the whole mirroring. I mean, you know, it's not that I hadn't read aspects of Lacan, wasn't interested. I was. And even was going to sign up at a Lacanian institute for a couple of years. But I didn't feel I knew Lacan in the way that I knew all the other authors that I had taught for a long time. I had taught Lacan a couple of times, but it really, to put it in Winnicott's terms, I didn't feel it was in my bones.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right. Is there anybody you wish you'd not included that you included, or is that you have no regrets? I mean, is there someone you would have substituted or something like that?
Yeah, I feel the weakest chapter, in my view, is the chapter on Sullivan. And I included Sullivan because of, you know, my long-standing interest in treating schizophrenic patients, you know, which I am going to write about at some point in some detail.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a weak chapter. I feel that I had nothing new to say about Sullivan, and I really feel I should have had a chapter on Jacobson included, who was certainly influenced me a great deal.
Yeah, I sensed a certain reticence in the Sullivan chapter, like an unwillingness, almost an unwillingness to engage fully with him.
But I think that's an accurate. Although, you know, for a while I certainly was definitely interested in Sullivan, but I felt the interest has not been enduring. And Erickson, I like Erickson a great deal, and I've taught Erickson, and I think I've read everything Erickson has written, but there was more the publisher saying, well, people aren't interested in Erickson any longer, and I listened. And that was, I think that was somewhat stupid on my part. On one hand, on the other hand, he even the book that you see presently, a 700-page book, he wanted to divide into two books, which I definitely didn't want. And he said any longer a book. And
it was kind of difficult to carry around with me when I was reading it. It was,
it's good exercise. You know,
yeah, that's right.
You need upper body things. It's useful.
That's good. You know, speaking of chapters, like the Sullivan chapter, I sense something was up there. Also, yeah, I'm curious, there are other chapters like Kernberg. you didn't write that chapter alone. There are chapters that you chose to kind of assign to others, or you wrote in concert, in cooperation with another author. So I'm curious about that, and in relation to that, well, yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. If there's any story behind there, particularly the Kernberg.
Kernberg's a good example. I mean, I thought there was a fairly well publicized, probably no one remembers it besides me, but I was Kernberg's discussant at when he presented in New York at a fairly, you know, there may be 500 or 700 people there. Mm-hmm. And both Kernberg and his wife felt, as she once said to me once when I said hello to her, and I said, I don't know if you remember me. She said, of course I remember you. You gave Otto the most critical discussion he's ever had.
Wow.
And I said, well, Otto's had a very good life. If that was the most critical, that was one Paulina. But you know, I think people, you know, and I felt that I had written another chapter that was probably too critical of Kernberg, and I really wanted in the book. I really wanted to stay balanced, except when I got to the commentary, insofar as I could. I wanted to stay balanced and really give the reader a sense of what the person said. So I thought, you know, Monica Karski, who's a very bright colleague, ex-student of mine, you know, is close contacts with Kernberg. So we wrote that chapter together. The Margaret Mahler chapter, you know, with Annie Bergman, I did it out of respect for Annie, who's a long-term colleague of mine, and, you know, obviously she's, you know, Mahler, Pine, and Bergman. She's had a long, you know, collaboration. I also thought I wrote a chapter, you know, the Art Lynch, Arnie Richards chapter. I thought I'm too critical of modern-day conflict theory.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want Hatchet Job. I didn't want it to be a political book in the way that I saw Greenberg and Mitchell's book as a political book. I wanted the commentary to really stand apart from, you know, the elucidation of somebody's position. And so where I didn't think I could do an even-handed job, I asked, you know, Art Lynch and Arnie, who are... You know, I thought that was, you know, and I thought for someone like Steve Mitchell, I thought I had a good deal of sympathy towards his position and where he came from.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought I was, I don't know how relational people felt, but I thought I was even-handed. I think Lou Aaron said he thought it was even-handed. I mean, I know he used the book for his reading group, so.
Okay. Yeah, so I thought. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. No, why don't?
No, I just. I just remembered that I felt a little bit like in the ego psychology on a Freud chapter. It's a little bit. There's a little strain there to be. I don't know, to be generous, but maybe I just read into that because of my own biases.
There, I wouldn't agree. I think both Hartman and Anna Freud are greatly underestimated. You know, and I particularly, with Hartman, use the metapsychology of schizophrenia, which most people don't know.
Oh, that's right. That's right. You really bring that out. Yeah.
You know, and to show how Hartman had very early ideas about the development of defense, the role of aggression, how he, you know, compares his views with Klein's, and he had read Klein. And I thought how Anna Freud was someone who really redressed a great deal of the excesses of, you know, some of the early Freudians, where she really was trying to say, look, the way you know something is through the patient's conscious state. You're not talking directly to their unconscious as you fantasize you're doing, and the way you interpret sometimes is somewhat out of control. And I thought Anna Freud's, you know, distinctions between ego inhibitive and ego restrictive ideas or defenses is a useful one. I had an appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I had a much stronger appreciation for Melanie Klein than for Anna Freud, but I think a lot of their differences can be bridged, not in some aspects of technique, but even there they can be bridged if you really look, you know, carefully and analyze the way Klein says she interprets, but she does it in such, in my view, empathic way most of the time that, people parody Klein, but I don't think they don't really mm-hmm. carefully do an analysis of the way Klein actually has talked to patients.
Yeah, I definitely felt the love for Melanie Klein. I also felt it for, especially, and I think this may be obvious to people who know you, but I felt it in the Winnicott chapter. It was very, very loving chapter.
I mean, that's, both of those are correct. I think those, for me, those are two of the most significant analysts. And I think Winnicott, in many ways, just as I think Bion, you know, I wrote a very long chapter on Bion, which I didn't want to cut down. I'm going to do something else with it. And so, you know, Victoria or Vicky Stevens, you know, wrote a much shorter one and a good one. But I didn't, because I thought, for me, Winnicott and Bion in a different way are both prime interpreters of the importance of Klein. In different ways. And I don't think people realize, you know, how well Winnicott in some ways grasped the importance of Klein beyond in a fuller way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you really bring that out in the Winnicott chapter for sure. Related to this a little bit, so at New Books in Psychoanalysis, we have this 5-year rule generally, meaning we only cover books published in the last 5 years. And okay. So you and I are just making it under the wire here in November 2015. But
how late New Books are.
But I have to say, I'm sort of glad to be interviewing you 5 years later because, well, first of all, because it's a very thick volume, and sometimes a volume like this requires some perspective, but also related to that, because 5 years ago when the book first came out, I think, you were teaching a class at NYU postdoc, and I was in that, I was not in analytic training then, but Lou Aaron and you generously allowed me to audit the class. And so, anyway, I remember you assigned most of your chapters, except I noticed, because they weren't marked in my book, the Sullivan chapter, which you mentioned you didn't love, and Mahler, I think you did not assign, and maybe a few others, but I guess my question is, now that you've been teaching the book for, have you been teaching it for the last 5 years? I assume you have.
Not every year, but yes. I mean, I've taught it again at NYU postdoc, and I've taught it at IPTAR three mm-hmm. times.
Do you feel like some chapters work better pedagogically than others? Or, I mean, I guess, how is your teaching of the book changed over time, if at all, or changed your perspective on the book?
Well, it's gotten me to want to write a new book, around that emphasizes some aspects of this book, but, you know, puts it much more into clinical terms, which I do in chapter 17, but, you know, there wasn't enough room, you know, for all of that, around that. But I think if I was going to do this again, I probably would take out the Sullivan and the Mahler chapter. write somewhat more about, I mean, if it was just going to be in one book and not another book on technique, if I was going to do it all in one book, I would write much more about, you know, some of the things I'm writing about now, you know, the analytic third into subjectivity, the limitations of those concepts. And I would, since it has been in the last 2 or 3 years, I've been reading almost entirely in French psychoanalysis.
Oh.
I would include French and Italian, you know, which is going to be a strong emphasis in the next book.
Oh, I was going to actually ask you about the Italians. Oh, good. Yeah.
You know, because, you know, I don't know if I was when you, was I the program chair of the IPA when you were taking the course?
Possibly. It was 2010.
Yeah, well, 2011. You know, I don't know. I probably didn't mention it. I knew I was the program chair. but probably wasn't terribly relevant to the course. But Nino Ferro was on my committee.
Oh, okay.
He was head of Europe, and Roberto Doria Mendina was head of South America. And so I got to know a great deal about some aspects of South American. I mean, I'd always see, there's a chapter that's going to be in my new book on Racker, who I thought was important. And actually, there's an interesting story about Racker and Etchegoyen, if we have time. I don't really include Mahler or Sullivan. I do include Bion in a stronger way, and I include more of the Neoclinians, particularly Ron Britton.
Mm-hmm.
And that's much more a way. I don't remember if that's what I did when you took the course.
And you assigned some Neoclinians, yeah, maybe to compensate for that, or, you know, you assigned a lot besides your book, but you organized the other readings around the chapters. So,
mm-hmm.
Speaking of technique and the clinical, I had this in mind to ask you that, you know, that the implications of all this theoretical integration for technique. I didn't feel like there was a ton on technique, but I started to think what the integrative work you did do, how it would look, what it would look like in the consulting room. I mean, can you say a little bit about that? I know it's a huge question.
anything you can
tell me would be yeah. Great. Yeah.
Well, I mean, one thing neither of us mentioned is my chapter on COVID.
Okay.
Which I also thought was an important chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And some mention of Shelley Bach. You know, so from my perspective, something that Winnicott, Klein, Bion, Racker in a different way, and Kohut and Shelley Bach all talk to is how to enter the patient's world. And with different patients, there are different aspects. So that with some patients, it seems to me projective identification is a key concept that you have to constantly be thinking about, you know, what the patient is putting inside of you and how you're responding to it. With other patients, and I think patients that Kohut writes about, Kohut, from my point of view, really writes about patients who really don't want to really tolerate a two-person field, forget mm-hmm. about, you know, but really want a certain kind of self-object world for a period of time. And it's, you know, when you start to experience some things like a Neo-Kleinian or Kleinian analyst would talk about, it's then that you start to see that the self-object transference starts to become unhinged, and there's some space for the other to start to make an intervention that starts to look more like an interpretive intervention. Because from my point of view, Kohut really never fully interprets in the way that I would consider interpretation. Interpretation, that is, to really explicate unconscious fantasy. And so from my point of view, I try to take elements of Winnicott's ideas about entering the patient's world as well. When he writes about patients where reliability, and the analyst being able to contain, he doesn't use contain, but he uses concepts where Bion probably should have credited him for the idea of containment, is more crucial than interpretation. So, I see a variety of analysts, including Bion, who are really talking about, ideas of mirroring, synthesis, containment, and ways of entering the patient's world so that the patient is, able to tolerate and utilize interpretive comments. And so it seems to me some of the synthesis, that I've talked about in the theories, start to take place in my ideas about technique. So that for me, Jessica Benjamin's idea about intersubjectivity, as I think I wrote in this book, but I might not have, but I wrote it some other place, if not in this book, is something that's a better, is an idea of a developmental occurrence as opposed to a theoretical postulate in the way that, say, someone like Stollero talks about intersubjectivity. And so it seems to me, that intersubjectivity, if you think about it as a developmental concept, you're thinking about something that shouldn't be taken as a given in the way that, say, Ogden does, or that the analytic third, for me, also isn't a given. It's something that can occur in analysis at some point, and that sometimes we have to talk about fractions, one and one-eighth, and things like that, rather than even a two-person field for some patients till really the treatment begins and something that I've called analytic trust develops in a way that allows the analytic couple to both be together and separate somewhat so that they tolerate an alternative perspective. So in writing about those kinds of things, I utilize a variety of theoretical concepts that I think are important.
So this sort of integration helps you deal with a wider range of patients or just gauge what a patient needs in the moment in a given period of time. It gives you more versatility. It gives you more versatility.
It seems right,
and
I think allows you to enter a wider variety of patients' worlds than. Right. So the whole idea of a patient being unanalyzable, for me, is somewhat a foreign concept.
I was thinking about actually another meta question about integration. How do you think of? I mean, you speak to this a little bit, of course, in the book, or throughout the book, really. But maybe for our audience, you can talk a little bit about what theoretical or clinical, integration really means, because, it's clearly just not simply eclecticism, and it's not simply kind of juxtaposing various things or seeing connections. There's something much more synthetic, or you're trying to do something much more synthetic here. So what would be, what would be integration? What is the method there?
Well, the method there is really to develop a theory that, in a sense, is a movable theory that can explain different phenomena. For instance, in the last chapter, I take a look at, you know, why some babies look Winnicottian and some babies look Kleinian. You know, and try to say, well, we can stay within, you know, a theoretical matrix. If the theoretical matrix has, you know, is a multiple factor theoretical matrix that says sometimes one factor is more important than another, and develop a way of, you know, having a way of understanding the mixture of these factors that produce, you know, quite different looking babies and quite different looking mother-infant interactions. You know, and so that's the attempt all the way through. You know, I have to say that the base is a quasi-Freudian base, but more so in the questions that Freud asks than in the answers that he provides.
I noticed that you do ask certain fundamental questions throughout the book about development, and you're bringing up the baby made me think of it, that like the concept of Freud's concept of the purified pleasure ego appears over and over again. Another recurring issue that, you know, appears over and over again in the book is the question of whether an infant is, you know, at first pleasure seeking or object seeking. And maybe you can speak to both, like autoerotism on the one hand, the purified pleasure ego on the other.
Well, you know, to take the second question first,
okay.
I thought that was a particularly poor question that Fairbairn asked. even though I thought he added a great deal in terms of some of his concepts. But, you know, the way many babies become object-related is through the cessation of pain or the ontogenesis of pleasure. Pleasure through various kinds of survival issues. And so, it's part of the reason I brought up the holding research in Chapter 18, that holding is an extremely... It's not that the baby is genetically object-related, or, you know, probably somewhat, or genetically pleasure-seeking, somewhat, but those things really ideally come together, and that for baby, holding is both object-related and pleasurable. You know, and with some babies probably need, you know, more pleasure and are more active in terms of seeking pleasure than others. And some babies probably, you know, need to be soothed and calmed in a different way. And, you know, I try to get at one of the factors in this type of development by the idea of underlying different kinds of endogenous stimulations or internal stimulation, which I think goes on all the time. And fortunately, people like Damasio and others and Pancek are starting to give some validity to concepts like they call it drive. I no longer call it drive. I once presented a paper, sent a paper to Science on REM deprivation and intracranial self-stimulation. I used the term drive, and it was rejected. And a friend of mine who was an editor said, don't use the term drive. Just change that one word. I did, and put in endogenous stimulation instead of drive, and the paper was accepted.
Wow.
That's the only change that I made.
Yeah. I mean, so much of this is semantic, like... the idea of, you know, this question of whether the baby at first, if there are objects early on, and it depends how you define object, you know, it's like, I think you make that clear throughout that this is where these arguments over the years have really taken shape over, you know, but yeah.
And divided. So, yeah. You know, and look, clearly, you know, some babies clearly find some things extremely pleasurable. You know, you don't need to be an animal researcher to know some babies just like to look. Or, you know, if you do an experiment with rats, you can get them to work fairly hard just to look at things. It's built into the organism in terms of both pleasure and survival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now that, well, I was going to ask you also if you talked a little bit about technique, but how did the writing and teaching of the book affect your practice, do you think? It sounds like you already practiced in this integrative way before you wrote the book. Did something happen in the course of the writing or afterwards?
Well, when I finally wrote the book, I wrote it for this length of book relatively quickly.
Did you have the chapters prepared like long in advance, or were you writing this book your whole career in a way?
Well,
it's a 700-page book.
but actually, the actual writing probably was 2 years. But as I would, I mean, I wasn't exactly kidding, you know. One perceptive patient said, you know, it feels like every once in a while you're changing theories.
No.
And I think that had to do with different things that I was writing. But I think the book did solidify the idea of, you know, integrative attempts, both in terms of theory, developmental theory, structural theory, and most importantly, for me at this point, technique.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what my next book is.
We'll talk about that in a second. I just wanted to ask you something else about the Freud chapters, the four Freud chapters, because before,
sure.
Yeah, it seems like, I was thinking about who are the figures in the book who enable the integration, who really stand, you know, who kind of are, to me, the big three are, maybe you can add somebody, but Freud, Winnicott, and Klein. I don't know. Without them, I'm not sure. Maybe Fairburn. I don't know. But it would be hard to imagine this book. What do you think about that? And because I also thought before doing anything, you sort of had to integrate Freud himself. A little bit, or at least you had to choose which Freud you were going to kind of use for the integration, and it seems like it was the object relations Freud that really came out.
Well, clearly,
the middle Freud, yeah.
Right, and I think it's also, I mean, a long time ago, as you mentioned, I wrote a book of Freud's technique papers,
mm-hmm.
and Freud's technique papers are written at the same time that what I call his object relations era is taking place, or other people call it, you know, a lot of his metapsychology papers, but mm-hmm. metapsychology is a bad name for those papers because most of them really have to do with early development, his ideas about the development of love and, you know, what it means. And there's a quote from Freud that I frequently like, you know, in the beginning of the third section of the paper on narcissism, where he says, look, if you look at Adler, he takes Adler and says Adler's idea of masculine protest is very similar to our idea of castration anxiety. And then he goes on to say he knows of various neuroses where the castration anxiety plays no part at all.
Hmm.
And so... When I used to attend New York Psychoanalytic Institute, to be particularly annoying, I would say to people, well, what do you think? What were Freud's psychosexual stages in 1913?
Yeah.
You know, and...
I think I know because I read your book, but...
Right, but most people, but almost nobody would know, not mm-hmm. the instructors or the students, that Freud was talking about autoerotism, narcissism. From my perspective, the editors of the standard edition would say in 1913 it was anal sadism. But I would say he was really talking about object choice, and then object love. So none of those things sound like traditional mucous membrane ideas. So when I presented that, say, New York Medical School Psychoanalytic Institutes, and I presented these ideas, you know, to a class that Arnold Rothstein asked me to present, he said, Freud never said that. And I said, well, look, what I'm telling you that Freud said is mirrored in what the editors of the standard edition would say his stages were: autoerotism, narcissism, anal sadism, and object love. I'm just changing object choice, because I think that really is a much better reading of what Freud was talking about in his Choice of Neurosis paper in 1913. But there's a really anachronistic attempt to say that Freud always was talking about, you know, oral, anal, and phallic. As a variety of people, as LaPlanche is someone who says, look, you should read three essays and make sure you take out all the footnotes that Freud puts in, you know, later.
Right, leave the 1905 text.
And you'd see the 1905 text is very different than your ideas about what Freud meant by three essays of sexuality. You know, I've been saying that for many years, trying to get people to sort of see where Freud was. You know, and in many ways, Freud's later, you know, emphasis on the Oedipal period, because up to 1915, only one neurosis was in what he might call the Oedipal period in object love, and that was hysteria. Everything else was before the Oedipal period.
So that focusing on that or emphasizing that part of Freud enables you to then reach out to these other theorists. Or,
right.
Go ahead. Yeah, corral them or whatever.
Right. And, yeah, and to also say, you know, projective-introjective mechanisms, which I try to point out, you know, was originally a frenzy idea in 1909, was something that Freud embraced in his idea of the purified pleasure ego, which was the beginning of narcissism for Freud. And so where things were then divided into all good and all bad, you know, which is what he meant by the purified pleasure ego, and that occurred through projective, introjective mechanisms, very similar to what Klein talked about in terms of projective identification.
So we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to get maybe a story or two out of you before we get to your current book. I don't know. You mentioned you had a who was the story you mentioned you had you it was some about somebody.
I was interviewing Etchegoyen when the IPA was in Barcelona. And I did it for Arnie Richards, you know, which he then used in in JAPA when Arnie was editor of JAPA. So I was. And he was then president of the IPA, and I was on the executive board of the IPA. So I knew I couldn't be late to the meeting. There was a meeting right after our interview because he was president and he was going to, you know, hold the meeting. So, and he was delightful, you know, Etchegoyen. It was when he had written that long book on technique, which is a very good book. And so, you know, we're coming, the meeting was at 2:30, it's now 2:20, we're in one hotel, we have to go to another hotel, it's about, you know, and I said, you know, we should go because you're chairing the meeting. He said, no, Otto wants to chair the meeting. Otto was president-elect. He said, I'm going to let Otto chair the meeting. I said, oh, well, then I better go because Otto is not that fond of me. Anyway, and he said, no, he said, you know, he had read some article of mine where I mentioned Racker. He said, do you teach Racker, don't you? I said, yes. He said, well, how did Racker start his book? I said, well, he started his book by, you know, there was a patient who, you know, left the session and paid paid his bill as he was leaving and said, this man's a thief. You know, had the thought, the patient had the thought, this man's a thief. You know, and when the patient comes back the next session, Racker hands him the check and says, I'm no thief. You know, and that all that went on non-verbally. And Etchegoyen said, that's right, that's how it begins. And I'm giving a facsimile of how it begins. And Etchegoyen said, do you know who the patient was? I said, no. He said, I was the patient.
Oh, my God.
So here's this guy who's president of IPA, who's just written, I don't know, an 800-page book. And seemingly the thing he was proudest of was that he was a patient of Racker's. So I'm going down. So he continues to talk to me, and he's a very engaging, you know, talker. And as he's telling me this story, Etchegoyen is a very demonstrative guy, and he puts his arms around my neck.
Oh my
and
God!
I'm still walking towards, because I don't want to be late to the meeting, and I'm thinking, he's a small, relatively small man. How would I look if I'm carrying Etchegoyen into the meeting with him draped around my neck? Because I didn't think I could get him off until I had answered the question that you know, about how Racker began. But Etchegoyen was I think, a very, very good interpreter of Klein, and softened Klein in a way that really made Klein very accessible to many South Americans. Hmm. So that's
it's a good story. Thanks for telling that. So now we really are out of time, but I wanted, of course, to ask you about what you're working on now.
Well, as I've said, as I've tried to popularize or in some ways propagandize several times that I'm writing a book on technique.
What about it?
Yeah. And it's going to be everything you wanted to know about technique, but we're afraid to ask at your institute.
Wow.
So, since hopefully it'll go across institutes, institute boundaries, and really be an integrative attempt.
Is it going to be an 800-page book?
The publisher has said.
I don't know why I asked that question. I don't care. I don't. I'll read another 800-page book by you. You know, I have one. Why not another?
They would like a shorter.
They would like
a shorter version this time. But I mean, once I start writing, I actually enjoy writing. So who knows how long it'll be?
How far along are you? Is it close?
Well, you know, I've put together, about 20 past papers. Mm. And I thought I would do it that way, but I decided that's not really a way to, you don't enjoy writing that way. So I've written, I would say, about 100 pages of new text, and I don't think I'm going to use past papers.
Mm. Good. It'll be fresh.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, we should wrap up. Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Stephen Ellman about When Theories Touch, a historical and theoretical integration of psychoanalytic thought by Carnac, 2010. Thanks again for joining us, Steve.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks. And thanks to our audience for listening. Till next time.